Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take your source material and really unpack the most interesting and useful insights. Today, we're diving into pesticides. Specifically, we're looking at some detailed info drawn from sections of understanding pesticides, types, hazards, and formulations.
Yeah, and our goal here, our mission for this deep dive is really to get a clear handle on what pesticides actually are. You know, how potential dangers are measured, how they're categorized, and also the many different ways they're formulated for use. It's quite a lot.
Think of this as your guide, sort of cutting through the jargon to get to the foundational concepts around these substances. They're everywhere, really. So let's get started.
Okay, first things first, let's unpack this. What exactly is a pesticide, according to our source material here?
Well, simply put, it's defined as any substance used to control or prevent, eradicate, or even repel any pest organism. And that definition, it's probably broader than you might think. It even includes things like adjuvants, those are added to improve application, or even products just used to defoliate a plant, make the leaves drop off.
Right. And the source immediately gets into something really critical, this idea that, okay, all pesticides are toxic. They have to be, right? They're designed to kill pests.
Yeah.
But toxicity alone isn't the whole story when it comes to, you know, actual danger.
Exactly. That's maybe the single most crucial point. The hazard a pesticide poses, the actual risk to you or the environment, it's a combination of its inherent toxicity and the amount of exposure you have to it.
Right.
And exposure isn't just one thing. It can happen through skin contact, eyes, ingestion, breathing it in, and how you're exposed really matters.
So just because something tests as highly toxic in a lab setting, that doesn't automatically mean it's like super hazardous in every single situation.
Not necessarily, no. The source points out lots of factors can change things in the real world, like how much time has passed since application, what kind of water was used for mixing, even things like UV light, temperature, soil microbes. They can all affect how toxic the pesticide remains and how long it lasts its half-life. Oh, and even things like impurities in the batch or mixing different pesticides together, that can alter the toxicity or how long it sticks around too. It gets complicated.
Okay, so hazard depends on toxicity and exposure. How do scientists figure out the toxicity part? The source mentions lab testing.
Right. A key method is using controlled tests. They give known doses to lab animals, often mice, rats, rabbits, dogs, and carefully observe the results. This is how they determine things like the lethal dose or lethal concentration. They're looking for the amount that kills 50% of the test population. If it's a dose that's ingested or absorbed through the skin, that's the lethal dose 50, the LD50. It's expressed in milligrams of pesticide per kilogram of the animal's body weight. So MGKG.
Okay, MGKG.
And if it's something inhaled, like a vapor or dust or maybe in water for aquatic tests, then it's the lethal concentration 50 or LC50. That's usually in micrograms per liter or milligrams per liter.
And a lower number means more toxic, right?
Yeah.
It takes less to cause that lethal effect.
Exactly. Lower LD50 or LC50 means higher acute toxicity.
And they also use these tests, the source says, to find the maximum dose that doesn't seem to cause injury, sort of a no effect level.
Precisely. That helps predict potential hazards to humans, but also to non-target organisms, you know, the ones you don't want to harm, like bees, fish, birds, wildlife. And of course, they also test on the target pests themselves. That helps figure out the right dosage rates for the label and check how well the pesticide actually works under different conditions, its efficacy.
Okay, so all this testing leads to the categories and signal words you see on the label. This seems really important for anyone handling these products.
Absolutely crucial. Federal regulations group pesticides into four categories, category 1, 2, 3, and 4, based on their potential to injure people, animals, or the environment. And these categories are communicated using specific signal words right there on the label. Big letters, usually.
Category 1 is the most hazardous, you said. What are the signal words for that one?
That uses danger, or sometimes danger poison, and it will have the skull and crossbone symbol too. The source actually notes that for these category I products, ingesting just a tiny amount, like a few drops up to maybe a teaspoon, could likely be fatal.
Wow.
Yeah, they have very low LD50 values, oral LD50 of 50 milligram kilograms or less, dermal LD50 of 200 milligram kilograms or less, highly toxic.
Okay, so danger poison is the top tier of hazard. What about the others?
Category 2 uses the signal word warning. Then categories 3 and 4 both use caution. Though sometimes Category 4 products might not have any signal word at all if the risk is considered very low.
And there are specific thresholds for LD50s and LC50s, and even eye and skin irritation effects that define each category.
Yes, the source has a table detailing all that. Like, Category 2 warning has an oral LD50 between 50 and 500 milligray kilograms. Category 3 caution is above 500 milligray kilograms, and eye effects range too from irreversible damage in category I down to irritation that clears up within a week for category 3.
But it's key, as the source points out, that these signal words are primarily about acute human toxicity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Specifically for the handler.
That's right. They're focused on the immediate risks to the person mixing, loading, or applying the pesticide. And different signal words mean different safety requirements. Like, you generally need to wear coveralls when mixing or applying anything labeled danger, danger poison, or warning.
And many danger pesticides are federally restricted use, meaning you need special certification.
Correct. Only certified applicators can buy and use those. And some states, like California mentioned in the source, have even stricter rules, classifying some as California restricted materials with additional requirements. So always check local rules too.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, the source also shows that pesticides aren't just, you know, one big group. They're organized in several different ways, which helps in understanding and selecting them.
Right. Multiple lenses to view them through. You can group them by what pests they target, their chemical family, how they actually kill the pest, their mode of action, and importantly, how they're packaged, which is the formulation.
Let's break those down. First, by pest target. That seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it's probably the most intuitive way. Got algae. Look at algicides, weeds, herbicides, insects, insecticides. The source lists a whole bunch. Bactericides for bacteria, avicides for birds, fungicides for fungi, atericides for mites and ticks, nematicides for nematodes.
Rodenticides for rodents, molluscicides for snails and slugs.
Exactly. Even silvicides for trees and shrubs. And some chemicals, like certain oils, might target multiple types of pests. So this grouping helps you quickly find potential options just based on what problem you're facing.
Okay, next up. Organizing by chemical family. How's that useful?
Grouping by chemical structure often reveals shared characteristics. Things like their mode of action might be similar within a family, or how long they tend to stick around in the environment, their persistence, how they break down. So the source mentions organophosphates, for example. Generally known for being acutely toxic, they mess with the nervous system, but they tend to break down relatively quickly, often work on contact. Then you have carbamoebas, also affect the nervous system, but some can be systemic, moving within the plant, and they work a bit differently, inhibiting enzymes. Or triazines, another family. They can have environmental impacts, like affecting fish reproduction, and they tend to persist in soil and move with water. Pyrethroids, another group, also hit the nervous system, but bind tightly to soil.
So understanding the family gives you clues about potential risks, how it behaves environmentally, maybe even resistance issues.
Exactly. It adds another layer of understanding beyond just it kills bugs.
All right, moving on to mode of action. This tells us how the pesticide actually does the killing, the mechanism.
Precisely. It's the specific process the chemical uses to interact with the pest and disrupt its life functions to destroy it. An herbicide might block photosynthesis, like stopping the plant from making food. An insecticide might prevent an insect from forming its exoskeleton properly so it can't molt.
And why is knowing the mode of action so important?
It's really critical for selecting the right pesticide, but maybe even more so for managing pesticide resistance. That's a huge problem. If you keep using pesticides that kill pests in the exact same way, you're basically selecting for the few individuals that happen to be resistant to that specific mechanism. By rotating chemicals with different modes of action, you make it much harder for resistance to build up in the pest population.
Okay. So variety is key there.
Definitely. And modes of action can be broadly described too, like contact only works where it touches, or systemic, absorbed and moved through the plant or animal. But within those broad types, there are very specific biochemical mechanisms. Scientists often assign group numbers to these modes of action, like from the WSSA for herbicides or IRSE for insecticides, to help applicators track and rotate them properly.
The source gives examples like glyphosate that's systemic, group 9 blocks a key plant enzyme, or paraquat, which is contact, group 22, messes with photosynthesis directly. Big difference in how they work.
Huge difference. Knowing that helps you use them effectively and responsibly.
Okay, the last way of organizing mentioned is formulation. And the source makes a big point that you don't usually buy the raw chemical. It comes formulated. Why?
Right. The pure active ingredient, the actual chemical that kills the pest, is often tricky stuff. It might not mix well with water, maybe it's unstable, or just too hazardous or difficult to handle safely in its raw form. So manufacturers add other things, they call them inert ingredients, but they're important. Things like carriers, like clay or solvents, emulsifiers to help oil and water mix, stabilizers, dyes, enhancers. They create a formulation that makes the pesticide safer, easier to handle, store, mix, and apply effectively.
So the product you buy is the active ingredient plus all this other stuff. And the label tells you how much active ingredient is in there, like as a percentage or pounds per gallon.
Yes. And the type of formulation has a massive impact on how you apply it, its benefits, and its drawbacks, especially relating back to hazard and exposure.
Right. This ties back to the hazard discussion.
Absolutely. Think about wettable powders, often labeled WP. They're usually high in active ingredient, which is efficient. They tend to be less likely to injure the plant itself, less phytotoxicity, and they mix well with other products. But they can be abrasive to your sprayer equipment. You need to keep the tank agitated so the powder doesn't settle out. And the big one, that fine dust, poses a significant inhalation hazard when you're mixing it.
Okay, compared to, say, emulsifiable concentrates, ECs.
Yeah, ECs are liquids. The active ingredient is dissolved in a solvent with an emulsifier added. They mix easily with water, penetrate surfaces well, generally require less agitation than WPs. But the solvents can make them more easily absorbed through skin or protective clothing if spilled. They pose a greater eye injury risk. They can be more likely to cause phytotoxicity. And those solvents can sometimes damage rubber or plastic parts on sprayers or even painted surfaces.
Different set of pros and cons entirely.
Totally different. Or take granules, G. Or pellets, P. These are dry, relatively large particles. Huge advantage. Much less likely to drift off target compared to sprays or dusts. And way less dust or mist hazard for the applicator during handling.
But the downside?
Well, some need to be worked into the soil mechanically, or they need rain or irrigation to release the active ingredient and become effective. Application might be less uniform than a spray.
So the formulation dictates so much about the practical use and the risks.
It really does. And there are tons of others the source mentions briefly. Dry flowables or water dispersible granules, DFWGG. Soluble powders, SP. Flowables, F. Water soluble concentrates, S. Ultra low volume concentrates, ULV for specialized equipment.
Slurries, invert emulsions, dusts themselves.
Micro encapsulated materials, those have the pesticide coated in tiny plastic spheres for slow release. Sounds good, but can be a problem for bees if they mistake the beads for pollen.
Oh, interesting hazard.
Yeah. And water-soluble bags, WSB, WSP, you just drop the whole pre-measured bag into the spray tank, it dissolves. Great for reducing handler exposure during mixing.
Baits, too. Designed to attract pests.
But potentially attractive to non-targets like pets or wildlife, too, so placement is key. And impregnates, used on things like ear tags for livestock. Each one has its own specific handling needs, equipment requirements, and safety profile.
Choosing the right formulation is clearly a big part of using pesticides safely and effectively. It's not just about picking the right active ingredient.
Not at all. It directly impacts the exposure part of the hazard equation.
Okay, one last piece mentioned in the source. Adjuvants. These are things added to the spray tank besides the pesticide formulation itself.
Correct. Adjuvants are extra materials you might add to the spray solution to improve something about the mixing, application, or overall performance. See, manufacturers try to make formulations work well under many conditions, but they can't possibly cover every single situation. Different water hardness, specific plant types, weather conditions. Adjuvants let the applicator customize the spray mixture for their specific needs right there, right then.
And what kind of things do they do?
Lots of different functions. Some are surfactants. They help the spray liquid wet the plant surface better, spread out instead of beading up. Some control droplet evaporation. Some make the pesticide stick better, resist washing off by rain. Others might increase penetration into the leaf, adjust the water's pH, improve how the droplets land on the target, make the mix safer for the target plants, fix compatibility problems if you're mixing multiple products, or, importantly, help reduce spray drift.
And the source makes a point that adjuvants themselves are actually classified as pesticides under the regulations.
Yes, that's an important detail. They have their own labels with instructions and precautions.
And sometimes the adjuvant label might even require more personal protective equipment, more PPE, than the main pesticide formulation you're mixing it with.
It's possible, yeah. You have to read all the labels involved, the pesticide label and the adjuvant label, and follow the most restrictive precautions listed on any of them.
which just reinforces that core idea again.
Yeah.
Everything you put in the tank, everything about how you apply it, contributes to the overall risk profile.
Absolutely. It all connects back to hazard being that function of inherent toxicity and the actual exposure. So let's quickly recap. We've covered the basic definition of a pesticide pretty broad. We've that really critical relationship. Hazard equals toxicity plus exposure. We look at how toxicity is measured, LD50s, LC50s, and how that translates into those label signal words, danger, warning, caution, which tell you about acute handler risk.
Right. And then the different ways pesticides are organized by the pests they target, their chemical family, which gives clues about behavior, their specific mode of action, which is key for resistance management.
And the formulation, how it's packaged, which dramatically affects handling, application, and exposure risk. And finally, those adjuvants for fine-tuning the spray mix.
Yeah, this deep dive, it really highlights the complexity behind these products, doesn't it? It's not simple. Understanding these different layers, the hazard versus toxicity exposure idea, the categories, the organization methods, formulations, adjuvants, it gives you a much clearer picture than just seeing a name on a bottle.
Yeah, it moves you beyond just knowing what a pesticide does to really understanding how it works, why it comes in a particular form, and the science behind how its potential danger is classified and communicated.
So here's a final thought to leave you with, building on all this. We've established that hazard is this combination of toxicity and exposure. And we've seen how many different formulations exist, seemingly designed specifically to alter that exposure. Think drift-reducing granules versus easily absorbed liquids. So how much does focusing on safe handling practices and, maybe more importantly, choosing the right formulation for the situation become just as critical, or maybe even more critical sometimes, for managing real-world safety, both personal and environmental, compared to just knowing the pesticide's basic toxicity number, its LD50? Something to consider. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.